is your call. As I said earlier, we're doing our Friday Media Roundtable today, and we're discussing coverage of the 2016 presidential campaign. Wait, I know you've heard a lot about it already, but we promise you something fresh and astonishingly intelligent here today. It's 3 days after Super Tuesday, and a fiery, riveting on-camera debate between two CNN commentators about racism and the Ku Klux Klan. We're going to play a clip of that. And it's 1 day after a alleged Republican candidate's debate that somehow managed to descend to new lows of vulgarity and viciousness. We'll talk about that as well. And we'll look at how well the media has navigated this campaign and what improvements might yet be made. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Your calls and emails are welcome. Meanwhile, let me introduce our guests, please. Joining us are two individuals who are incredibly well-situated to illuminate these issues. First, John Nichols. John's the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's a contributing writer at The Progressive and In These Times and an associate editor at Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. His new book, co-authored with Robert McChesney, is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Welcome, John.
Great to be with you, Mark.
Okay. And also with us is David K. Johnston. He's been on your call before. And David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, columnist for USA Today, teaches business, tax, and property law at Syracuse University. Best-selling author, his latest book is Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. But also, David K. Johnston has done some of the very best substantive reporting on Donald Trump. We welcome you, David K. Johnston.
Glad to be here, Mark.
Thank you, David. So, as we always do, to begin our Friday Media Roundtables here at KLW, let's try to start off on a positive note and give a kudos to a reporter or a news organization who did a good job this week. David, what's at the top of your list? What did you see this week in journalism that you admired?
Well, in my hometown newspaper, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, they have a very good reporter on culture named Will Blaine, and he has a piece about a 79-year-old retired professor at Cabrillo College in Aptos near Santa Cruz, who, along with other parents, have bought some several acres of land in Santa Cruz to create a community for disabled children who are now adults, including his 23-year-old son who has cerebral palsy. And on one level, this is a wonderful story about people working to come up with a solution to a problem, namely, this kid is going to seriously outlive his father. But it also draws attention to the immoral sick care and disability systems we have in America that say if you're unlucky, if you end up, for example, being someone who has cerebral palsy, we're not going to take care of you. And this is an issue that politicians have done their absolute best to ignore. And I think this story puts some light on and should make us think about how our moral conduct as a nation is reflected in the way we care for the least among us.
David, could you just remind us, we'll of course put a link to this on our website, but what was the reporter and what was the news organization?
It's I've sent you the link. It's Wallace Bain, B-A-I-N-E, who writes about books and culture and things for the Santa Cruz Sentinel.
Very good.
And the story ran on Wednesday.
Okay, very good. And John, who I should say with full disclosure is my colleague at The Nation magazine, very good to be on the air with you, John. What did you see this week, if anything, that you admired?
I always see a lot that I admire, and David's story sounds great. And also, what an honor to be on with my able colleague who knows as much about media as anybody I know. My story, I've got two of them, and I'll do them quickly. First off is I had to flee the United States for hopeful news. And so I found in my great hero, Fintan O'Toole, the wonderful cultural and political columnist for the Irish Times in Dublin. Ireland just had a big election, and they were voting on a whole host of issues, including austerity, the blaming of the poor for the problems created by the rich. And in the election, they kind of ripped up everything. It was a very volatile, very chaotic election that produced relatively uncertain results, and it may sound familiar. And Fintan wrote this fabulous article six reasons to take pride in general election 2016. And then the subhead was, we are not racist, stupid, greedy, lacking in moral direction, guilt-ridden, or chicken. And he went down all the reasons why in Ireland's very chaotic election, they actually confronted big issues. They raised small parties up. They challenged the establishment and elites. And he saw in the chaos hope for his country. It's a beautifully written article, as all of his are, and I highly recommend it. Again, it's Fintan O'Toole at the Irish Times. The piece appeared. It appears actually, I think it was on Tuesday, March 1.
Okay, good.
The other one I just want to cite quickly is coming back to the domestic side, and that's from the Denver Post, and their political writers, John Murray and John Frank. A couple days after the Colorado caucuses on Super Tuesday, which were won overwhelmingly by Bernie Sanders, he got about 60% of the vote to 40% for Hillary Clinton, they had an article headlined, Bernie Sanders may not have won Colorado after all. And then the subhead is, Sanders easily wins popular vote across most of state, but delegate count may mean a tie. And they actually detail what I think is one of the great crises of the political process in America. Both parties are mangling this primary and caucus process. But one of the real problems on the Democratic side, which is that when a state votes overwhelmingly for a candidate, that doesn't necessarily mean that candidate gets most of the delegates. In fact, it is possible, because of superdelegates and also a lot of other kind of tricks, turns, and twists, Hillary Clinton might get the majority of delegates from Colorado. And I thought that these two reporters for the Denver Post did a really able and thoughtful job, very easy job, of explaining a lot of the machinations and how it all works. I just think it's a great kind of inside politics story.
Terrific. Thank you, John. And so we're going to have links to all three of those stories on our website here. And let's dive in now further into the coverage. And I know that both of you and I myself have criticized a lot of the personality-driven coverage of this campaign. So let's start with something that kind of cuts the other direction here, which is the political economy of the TV business as a corporate profit-making enterprise and how that has influenced the coverage. And I want to start by reading a quote from the head of CBS, the CEO of CBS, an individual called Les Moonves, who said this actually here in San Francisco in December, and I think it's only more so now, that basically Donald Trump has been very good for television profits, and television profits have been very good for him. Here's what Moonves said in December. Go Donald. Quote, go Donald. Keep getting out there. Man, who would have expected the ride we're having now? Who would have thought this circus would come to town? But you know, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That's all I got to say. What can I say? It's, you know, the money's rolling in, and this is fun. Unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the CEO of CBS, one of the major news organizations in this country, talking about how profitable Donald Trump's campaign has been for CBS and TV in general. David, could you speak a little bit to that, which is sort of this usually hidden underside of how television in particular approaches coverage of politics in this country?
This is a really serious problem. In December, an analysis came out that showed that ABC, a competing network, the ABC World News Tonight, had given 81 minutes of time to Donald Trump and less than a minute to Bernie Sanders.
81 to 1.
81 to less than 1. And, you know, networks are constantly breaking into what Trump says. And that's why, you know, a competent, reasonable person, I don't agree with him on the world, but he's a competent, reasonable person, John Kasich. Nobody knows anything about him because TV has shut him out, and their commercial interests are now championing what's happening. And what's troubling about this is the Democrats years ago voted to repeal the Fairness Doctrine. That's the one that said, you know, you had to give equal time and you had to cover all the sides of issues. And they did it on the theory that, well, you know, there are so many channels and we have cable and other ways to communicate and we don't need this anymore. And it's led to this. And so Donald Trump has gotten what amounts to hundreds of millions of dollars of free advertising because he's allowed to just drone on and on and never ask the questions that I would put to him if he was still talking to me. And this is really messing up our democracy. And if we get a brokered convention, the private conversations at the networks are going to be, oh my goodness, how much money we're going to make off of this.
And are you, how much of Trump's, you know, he's now widely seen, correctly or not, as the all but inevitable Republican presidential nominee this year, how much of his success in the polls would you attribute to these hundreds of millions of dollars in free advertising? John, why don't you take a crack at that?
Well, I love your gentleness, Mark, when you say hundreds of millions. You know, if you go across all the cable networks and radio and frankly print media as well, you're into billions. I mean, this is astronomical, the level of attention to Trump. On Super Tuesday night, I was given a speech in southeastern Wisconsin, and as I headed back to, I was then doing a BBC thing, and as I was heading to a studio, I had the radio on, and I have Sirius satellite XM radio, whatever all that is, and I had CNN on. And it was about 8:45, and I thought, well, I'll get it on, get the latest returns, I'll find out what's happening. Well, they were playing a Trump press conference. It went right through the 9 o'clock hour change and kept on going. They didn't even announce the results of Super Tuesday because it might interrupt Donald Trump. And this is huge.
That's pretty telling, isn't it?
Oh, boy. And I see it again and again and again.
So would Trump be ahead like this without this kind of free advertising?
No, he would not. Now, he might be a very viable candidate, but when you say ahead like this, understand, we are talking about a guy who is now very likely to be the nominee of his party. I think it would have been much more difficult if there had been an even-handed coverage. Now, but we can't always get that, and we shouldn't expect even-handed. It never has been throughout history. But it is now so disproportional that I would suggest we need to step back and recognize this isn't just affecting the Republican race, it is dramatically influencing the Democratic race. And the reason is that Donald Trump is now sucking all the oxygen, all the air out of the room. As a result, when you flip on a television, even radio, start to go to print, you're seeing article after article after article, report after report after report, discussion after discussion after discussion of Donald Trump. Do you like him? Do you dislike him? What's Mitt Romney doing about him? What does Hillary Clinton say about him? But what we're not getting is a clear coverage of both campaigns. It would be as if, and I know this is a historical reference, but back in 1976, when you had great races for the Republican and the Democratic nominations for president, throughout the campaign, all the networks did, all anybody did, was cover Ronald Reagan. That would have dramatically influenced whether Jimmy Carter was nominated. And I think people need to pause and recognize that this dramatic overemphasis on Trump is now causing a result in the Democratic side in that there is now so little attention to the Democratic race. We're seeing state after state with low turnout. We are also seeing, frankly, that the genuinely important debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders is frequently pushed aside as everybody rushes to talk about Trump.
You're listening to KLW. This is Your Call, the Friday Media Roundtable with David K. Johnston and John Nichols. I'm Mark Hertzgard. Because I don't want us to make the same mistake of talking only about Trump, I want to we will get back to Trump, and in particular, David, I want to talk to you about some of the substantive reporting that you've done that has not been asked about by the other press coverage of Trump. But let's talk for a second here. I don't know if both of you saw this, but on the night of Super Tuesday, there was an absolutely riveting on-camera debate on CNN, which I happened to catch live and said at the time, this is the moment of coverage. in this campaign, where it was fiery, it was entertaining, but it was also very substantive. And I'm talking about this back and forth between the commentators Van Jones, who, of course, used to work in the Obama White House, and Jeffrey Lord, who is a supporter of Donald Trump, who worked in the George W. Bush White House, I believe, or the Reagan White House. And we're going to show play a little clip of that in a second here. And they're talking about, this is about Trump, but it's also about, in particular, about the Ku Klux Klan, racism, and what role that has played, not just in the campaign, but in the coverage of the campaign. Here we go.
I think that we have taken him not seriously. We have not respected his voters. But there is a dark underside here. And Essie is right. He is whipping up and tapping into and pushing buttons that are very, very frightening to me and frightening to a lot of people. Number one, when he is playing funny with the Klan, that is not cool.
He didn't play funny with the Klan.
Hold on a second. I know this man when he gets passionate about terrorism. I know how he talks about terrorism. The Klan is a terrorist organization that has killed
a leftist terrorist organization.
You can put whatever label you want. That's your game to play.
No, that's your game to play.
No, they're not. We're not going to play that game.
No, we're not going to understand history.
You need to take a serious look at the fact that this man is playing fast and loose and footsie. When you talk about terrorism, he gets passionate. He says, "No, this is wrong." But when you talk about the Klan, "Oh, I don't know. That's wrong." And then you came on the air. And you said, well, this is just like when Reverend Wright was speaking.
Yeah.
Reverend Wright never lynched anybody.
That was Van Jones speaking most of the time there, and countering him was Jeffrey Lord on CNN on Super Tuesday evening, obviously referring to the controversies around Donald Trump failing to disavow the endorsement of David Duke, the Grand Wizard of the KKK. And in fairness, Jeffrey Lord said, and the Trump campaign has said, Mr. Trump did disavow that previously, but when asked about it on the big ABC Sunday morning show, he did not disavow him. So first David and then John. This has been a big theme this week. A lot of the rest of the media talking about that confrontation between Van Jones and Jeffrey Lord. How do you think that reflects on the general coverage of race in this campaign? David, can you start, please?
Sure. Well, Donald, who talks about the blacks and talks about people in terms of groups, Donald's father was arrested in a KKK demonstration in New York City in the 1920s. Donald has a long history of having been fined and penalized after he got due process for his companies engaging in discrimination. His biggest gambler, Bob Labuddy, who used vile, foul language, told me that he never asked to have blacks removed as dealers, that Trump did that because he thought it would curry favor with him. And, by the way, it's astonishing that Jeffrey Lord, and this is a very important theme that I see all over the place, says that the KKK is a leftist group. We're now hearing the progressives, really are Nazis. I mean, there's crazy things being said about the KKK, and Trump is playing both sides of this very brilliantly. When it's convenient to say, "Oh, I disavow that," he does. And at the same time, he sends a coded signal, the same way Ronald Reagan did when he began his campaign for president in 1980, not in a big city, not in any place you'd normally think of, but in the little town of Philadelphia, Mississippi, well known for one of the most awful murders in the civil rights era. And Reagan went, "Oh, I had no idea." But those people who are racist got the idea, "You're with us. You're against those people who aren't like us."
John Nichols, this week at least, because of that confrontation between Jeffrey Lord and Van Jones on CNN, racism has begun to be discussed in the presidential campaign coverage. How could the media have done better, and what can we look forward to going ahead on this?
Well, the media could have done a lot better, and the media can continue to do a lot better. One of the reasons why that clip is so significant is because Van Jones did something that doesn't happen very often, if at all. And the key to it is he challenged someone else on their spin. He challenged him on their running line. And when the other person tried to deviate in toward something advantageous to him, you know, like just throw off lines, which usually a host comes on and says, oh, let him speak, right? The host didn't interrupt. What made that TV good was because they were actually allowed to go at it. We don't do that in America. We don't go at it. And frankly, we don't have people like Jeffrey Lord, who I disagree with on just about every issue, who stand their ground on one side, and somebody like Van Jones, who I do agree with on a lot of issues, stand in his ground, and they really debate. What you saw there briefly was an actual debate. And we never see that. We almost never see that in America. So that's important. But the problem as regards coverage of race, gender, sexuality, a host of other issues that really are writ large across this race on the Democratic and the Republican side, is that our media is not comfortable with having real debate. And our media tends to be so siloed now that, you know, there's sort of a gentleness factor put on it. And when things get interesting, most of our shows try to dull it up as quick as possible. Well, let's let the other person, well, let's not get too heated here. And the bottom line is, some of these issues do open up really painful and difficult prospects, really painful and difficult ideas. And what you saw there on CNN was an opening of a good discussion. But frankly, Mark and David, I'm not hopeful. I don't like the way most of our media deals with these issues, because by and large, it doesn't go to the heart of it, and then people are surprised when things blow up and when there's all this underlying tension. And frankly, let's be clear, when somebody like Trump is able to win primaries and caucuses right after he said, you know, been very vague on his stance for the KKK. And if I could add one final element here, I thought one of the most remarkable things is on the very same morning that Donald Trump was struggling to say whether he objected to or rejected the KKK, he was also asked on another show about retweeting a quote from Mussolini. And his response was, well, it's a good quote. I mean, do you understand how far off the rails we have gotten, where we have a media and, frankly, a politics where the front-running candidate for the Republican nomination is talking about good quotes from Benito Mussolini?
You're listening to KLW's Your Call Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Mark Hertzgard. Our guests are John Nichols, my colleague at The Nation magazine, and David K. Johnston, who is one of the most informed reporters on Donald Trump, and who, we pointed out earlier in the show, is no longer spoken to by Mr. Trump. So we hope you'll join us for the next half hour of the show, and we'd love to hear from you as well. So please join the conversation. Here's the numbers. You know them. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And, of course, you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org, or leave a comment on our website, which is yourcallradio.org as well.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255, a toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today at Your Call, and this is the Friday Media Roundtable. And for those of you just joining us now, our guests today are John Nichols, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. His new book, co-authored with Robert McChesney, is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. And our other guest, David K. Johnston, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, columnist for USA Today. His latest book is Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And before we jump back into it, I just want to remind you all, you're welcome to join us with the phone numbers and the emails. And we're also podcasting our show. You can find more information about all of this stuff at the website, yourcallradio.org, where you can listen to the past shows, find out what's coming up next, and so forth. So let's dive into the second half here, David and John. And I want to talk, I want to pick up on a point that you made earlier, that so much of the coverage has been focused on Donald Trump and the Republican side, that the Democratic side of the debate, whether you're a Hillary Clinton person or a Bernie Sanders person or still undecided, has not gotten the attention that it might. And so I'd like to ask both of you to speak about that and also to address one of my own pet peeves for as long as I've been writing about media and politics and especially elections. What is the deal? Why the rush on the part of all of the media, whether they are the MSNBCs on the left or the Fox News on the right or the New York Times or whatever? What is the rush about everybody trying to declare that this election is over when, let's face it, most of the states have not even voted yet? David, could you begin on that, please?
Sure. Well, the problem is that we have reporters who are very good at covering the horse race and not at covering policy at all. I mean, this is the core problem. When Donald Trump was asked the very question by the very smart right-wing radio host Hugh Hewitt about the nuclear triad and gave an answer making it clear he had no idea what it was, and then Marco Rubio said, by the way, for those of you who don't know what the nuclear triad is, I said to my wife, well, this will be in all the newspapers tomorrow.
Ha.
No, not a chance. And so,
but David, is that the reporter's fault or the editor's and the manager's fault that that's not in the paper?
Well, the great power that editors have is placement. You know, you can take a piece of trash and put it on page one with a big headline, or you can take the most carefully, meticulously done investigation and bury it in the back of the paper. And trust me, I've been there many times at the LA Times, at the when I was working there, where exactly that happened. Never happened at the New York Times, fortunately. But that's a real problem. And so here's the other side of this. I did a piece a couple of weeks ago for the New York Daily News called You're with Bernie Sanders, Whether You Know It or Not. A significant majority of Republicans in polls support the things that Bernie Sanders is proposing. Universal health care, free tuition in college, expanding Social Security, reining in Wall Street. But they don't know that because on TV we hear socialist, 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 not what Bernie Sanders is for, which is market capitalism, but with rules that rein in bad behavior, which is what you have in Western Europe. And underlying this is the people who we call political reporters, and we should be calling them, by the way, politics reporters, not political reporters. They don't know policy. They are simply paid and rewarded by the system for the get, which means getting the candidate to come to the camera or come sit down for an interview, and for their telling you what the professional political class sees is going on, not for telling you what, as a voter, you need to know to make informed decisions.
That's David K. Johnston, and I want to turn to John Nichols now. John, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this show today is that you've kind of straddled both of those areas. You know a lot about policy, but you also have been reporting for years on campaigns and elections, and you like to get down into the nitty-gritty of who won that precinct and what's that going to mean for the election in the fall. So can you speak a little bit about this? You've also been covering Bernie Sanders for, heaven knows, decades. Talk a little bit about what David was just saying and this instinct, I guess, inside of the media to declare this race over, that Hillary and Trump are the de facto nominees already.
Well, I think you get to the heart of the matter, Mark, and David and his good comments. There's actually a pecuniary element to this, an economic element to this. much of our media today operates as a dumb beast. It simply wants to be fed. And it's fed, unfortunately, by clicks and by ratings and all these things. And you know, that's always been somewhat true, but it's dramatically more true now with the loss of traditional advertising dollars for a lot of our media. So they desperately want to have the biggest story. The minutia of a primary process, of a caucus process, is not as good for them as the huge clash, Clinton versus Trump, if that's where it ends up. They love that. And they love, you know, the big names that draw. They would, I can tell you this, the people you've been quoting, the network execs, if they could just put up a Clinton-Trump debate tomorrow, that'd be heaven for them. And so they like to push everybody aside who might actually want to talk about some policy, who might actually want to talk about ideas. And that even includes front runners. You know, I'll give you a very good example. This year, I think the most important speech that Hillary Clinton gave was, I believe it was back in June. It was a speech about the next economy, about the gig economy, and how we're going to have to adjust a lot of our thinking as regards social programs, as regards economic policy. She had actually spent an immense amount of time with, you know, professors at the New School and other places and really thought hard, gave a great speech, and it was up and gone in 10 seconds. About the only thing anybody was interested in was Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush criticizing her for not being, you know, into the 21st century, when in fact she was more so. The bottom line is, candidates learn very quickly that when they talk policy, they get pushed aside. When they start to attack one another, when they take cheap shots, when we have this week's degeneration into body part jokes, when that happens, they get attention. And so we have a terrible mess that is developing in our politics. This is not the last campaign of the 20th century. This is the first campaign of the 21st century. We are really starting to see where this thing goes unless we think very seriously about both our politics and our media. And the tragedy of what's going on here is that we are at a tremendous pivot point in our country. We're in the midst of a digital and automation revolution that is going to transform work and society. And yet, when these candidates even minimally try to talk about that, they're shunted aside. They're called boring. And the interesting thing is, it's only by recognizing the significance of the transition that's taking place that we start to understand why so many young people are interested in Bernie Sanders and why so many displaced older workers are interested in Donald Trump. It all comes back to those core economic issues, to this radical economic and social change that we're in the midst of, and yet our dumb beast media barely talks about it.
Yeah, you'd think that they'd see an opportunity there. We're going to go to some calls here. I just want to mention, John, to your point about how Hillary Clinton's substantive speech got ignored. Similar thing happened, of course, to Bernie Sanders when he gave a speech on foreign policy at Georgetown University, and nevertheless gets criticized throughout the debates by the media, by other candidates, for not laying out his vision. Okay, so we've got some calls, and before we take them, I'll just remind everybody listening, you're welcome to call in. The number is 866-798-8255, or email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we're going to go to Phil in New Mexico, who wants to ask David K. Johnston about the Koch brothers. Phil, welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. David, first, I just wanted to compliment an article you wrote when you were still with the New York Times. It was about Myron Scholes testifying when the IRS brought him up on tax fraud charges, and I still think it was one of the best articles I have ever read on a very complicated subject. So
thank you.
Thank you. It was a great article. And so on Trump, I have two questions. One is, why are the Koch brothers and their cronies so opposed to him? I saw that Larry Ellison of Oracle Computing fame gave $1 million to Marco Rubio, and I can guarantee you Larry Ellison is not a social conservative. And the second question is, what's it if Trump versus Ross Perot in 92, if Perot had been able to run inside the Republican Party, which he couldn't because George H.W. Bush was the incumbent, would his campaign have looked like Trump's today, or is Trump a fundamentally different animal?
Okay. Phil, let me deal with part two first. Ross Perot had a lot of nutty views, but he was a serious highly competent businessman who built a very good business after a career as an IBM salesman, a career he left because in January of one year he made the maximum he was allowed to earn. What a dumb policy they had at IBM. So I don't think that they're at all comparable except that they're insurgents. On the other issue, why did the Koch brothers say we're not going to fight Donald Trump? And yet, clearly, he's not following their interests nor Larry Ellison's. Donald Trump would be a disaster for business. I've written a number of pieces at nationalmemo.com about Donald. My book, Temples of Chance, goes through his business record. Donald is not a successful businessman. He's not worth anywhere near what he says he's worth. You'll notice that he has very little bank debt. That's because bankers don't trust him anymore, and so they won't loan him money except when it's highly secured, low-value loans secured by real estate worth much, much more. And so the question becomes, why aren't you guys really going out front to go after him? It's a fight they don't need to do. The Koch brothers don't need to take Trump apart and risk what they're trying to do. And don't ever underestimate the Koch brothers. They are good businessmen. They are good stewards of their businesses. They may not, you may not like what they do environmentally, but they have well-run businesses. They take good care of them. They are serious people, and they believe their stuff. And so demonizing them and stuff, as I've seen a lot of people do, and I'm not suggesting Phil is a big mistake. They're serious people. They need to be treated in a serious way. And their arguments, I believe, Americans will reject if they properly understand them.
David, I want to pursue this a little bit. You just said that a Trump presidency would be bad for business.
Oh, my goodness,
so,
yes.
Well, so why aren't the Koch brothers trying to prevent that outcome?
Probably because signaling they're going to try and damage him could backfire on them. They can do all sorts of subtle things. I mean, you're not going to see money rushing to Donald Trump for a campaign if he gets the nomination. You're going to see Republican leaders sit on their hands about this. They're not going to pour money into this guy. I mean, this is a man who thinks, first of all, understand, Donald Trump's vision of a presidency is not the very limited powers that the founders put in the Constitution with checks and balances. It's the powers of a dictator. The head of Carrier and the CEO of Ford will call me up promising they're going to undo what they think are their correct business decisions. He's running for dictator-in-chief. He's not running for president. And there are a lot of people who have authoritarian impulses, and he's very appealing to them, especially if they are part of the small minority of Americans, it may be as much as a fifth in the South, you know, who think we made a terrible mistake when we freed the slaves.
One more question here, David. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was either 19 questions or 21 questions. You did a piece about some months ago saying, here's 21 questions for my fellow journalists who are now
right.
That Trump is running.
Right.
And, you know, based on your extensive reporting of the stuff you just mentioned, how Trump does not have a good business record, is not trusted, et cetera, et cetera. My question to you this morning is, how many calls or contacts have you gotten from campaign political reporters throughout the rest of our colleagues in the media saying, gee, David, can you give me a little background on that? I'd love to follow up.
Yeah. Robert O'Hara of the Washington Post, one of the finest investigative reporters we have, called me, and he's written a piece so far that was quite good. It was tepid, but very good. Michael Isikoff at Yahoo News now, used to be at Newsweek and MSNBC, called me, and a handful of people at minor news organizations. No one from the big papers I used to work for, the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Detroit Free Press, the San Jose Mercury, the LA Times, has called me. And I did not anticipate when I wrote that piece, and I said way back when Donald announced, in fact, just before he announced when he was going to do it, that he was a serious candidate and might get the nomination. I was the only national journalist, I believe, who said, you need to pay attention. He may get the nomination. Not likely, but he might. I really expected those questions were not going to be posed by politicians, and we finally saw Rubio and Cruz ask questions that are absolutely right out of my 21 questions for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I noticed
but
that.
But I can't believe it took them so long. I mean, they should have been hitting Trump with this and squashing him down way back in September, Donald, who's very good at how to game systems, looked around, 17 candidates. Well, I don't have to win. If I can get 30% somewhere or 20% or 40%, I'm the one who's out ahead, and then I can call myself the winner.
Okay, but we're talking here about the media, so I don't want to let our colleagues off.
I saw that Rubio did that,
but why haven't they? Why? Tell us why you think they haven't gotten those calls.
The one answer I've heard back from some friends is that you have to know this stuff deeply because Trump will just bat it away. He's very good at doing that, and they don't know it deeply, and they haven't been given the time to do things like read my book, Temples of Chance, so they can understand these on a deep level. And because Trump creates situations where he doesn't respond. When you hit him with a hard question, he just bats it away. So he's figured out how to even defeat the few people. Like Katie Tours tried to get at a little bit of this. She's with NBC. He bats those away. It's a real problem the way we run the system now. You know, the reporters covering Trump are literally put inside a metal cage. They are corralled, so they can't even talk to the people who are there. And we had a Secret Service agent rough up a photographer who put a foot outside the cage. And I'm shocked that President Obama has not announced that, you know, there is an internal review or hasn't had somebody on his behalf announce that they are looking at the conduct of this agent. We should not have the organization whose job is to protect the president and candidates roughing up journalists, especially over something as absolutely minor as that incident. But reporters are simply not going to ask the 21 questions. So my recommendation to folks is go to the internet, put in my name, David C-A-Y, John Stun with a T, 21 questions for Donald Trump. It'll pop right up at nationalmemo.com. Read the questions, read the order of them, and pay very close attention to the financial transaction and behavior of Donald Trump's personal helicopter pilot, a major drug trafficker, and ask yourself what was going on there.
That's David K. Johnson. John Nichols, I want to bring you in on this. David's talking about how reporters can't be asking this. I'm sorry, if your helicopter pilot was a big drug runner and it were Bernie Sanders, don't you think that would be leading broadcasts, John Nichols?
Look, the fact of the matter is that the story of the 2016 campaign, and maybe you'll write it, Mark, because you've done pretty good jobs in the past of kind of breaking open some of our crises as regards media. But the story of the 2016 campaign is a media story. It is not a political story. And the key to this is that we have a group of traditional politicians and reporters who are used to covering traditional politicians coming into a campaign that has been disrupted by a non-traditional politician. Donald Trump hasn't studied politics. He's not an expert on politics. He studied media. He's really good at media. He's really good at self-promotion. He's really good at owning the moment. And what he has figured out is something that most of our media, I think many of our media players, even reporters and editors, and certainly most of the political people don't get. And that is that after the 2008 economic meltdown, our media culled out journalism. They laid off tens of thousands of reporters and editors and people who do the behind-the-scenes work, both on television, radio, and print. They've replaced some of it online, but very, very little, at a tiny ratio of what's been lost. And so as you culled out all of those journalists, you ended up with a desperate group of people who primarily want clicks and ratings. Not everybody. There are fantastic journalists out there who are still doing amazing work, and we could take the rest of the show to name them. But overall, in this media system, it's a dumb beast. It needs to be fed. Trump knows that. And so he knows full well that if he's hit with any of the questions that, you know, David has so well laid out, he knows how to say something more outrageous, quote Mussolini again, and get on to the next story. He knows how to kind of do a rope-a-dope around our existing media system, and our existing media system hasn't caught up to him. On the other hand, most of the rest of the candidates actually still try to answer questions.
Mark, I think that's exactly right. John has that exactly right.
Say that again, David.
I think, Mark, I think that John has articulated this exactly right, and the dumb beast thing, I call it the herd. Once the herd starts moving and gets the narrative, it's hard to stop it. But I think that's a brilliant analysis of it.
And if I can just add one final element. When David K. Johnson, who's one of my heroes, tells me I did a good analysis, I keep talking. But just the final element of it is that, this is something that people who at this point are sort of in this celebratory mode, some progressives, some Democrats are saying, well, now after those dumb Republicans failed to recognize Trump and failed to take him on, now we'll just expose him and we'll take him on and he'll be nothing. I warn you, I don't know as much about Donald Trump as a businessman as David does. But I know a lot about Donald Trump as a politician. I have watched him from the beginning of this. And frankly, in our previous book, Dollarocracy, we wrote about his consideration of running for president in the past. And this is one thing. He is bringing a new model to this, and the media hasn't caught up with him, and neither have the smartest people in the room in both political parties. So do not presume that the guy who appears to have beaten every smart consultant, every smart media person, everybody on the Republican side doesn't have a plan for beating every smart consultant and every smart media person on the Democratic side.
That's John Nichols, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. Let me get to an email or two here before we conclude. We got a couple more minutes here. An email from Rita in Berkeley says, quote, I think there should be much more concern placed on the Republican debates. They're two-hour shows in which three-plus candidates repeat the same lies, economy destroyed, Obamacare a disaster, horrible international relations, etc. And people listening to the debate may not know who they're going to vote for, but they will be pulled into the dangerous fiction being pounded into their heads. That's Rita in Berkeley. And now another email from Margaret. I'd appreciate knowing what happened to the equal radio time rule for each candidate. This is a very good program. It's the best I've heard on the campaign so far, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. And one more email before you guys jump on that question. This is from David. I appreciate the scuffle that Trump chump stirs up about reining in bad practices by businesses when he's as bad as those accused. The saying about beware of the devil you wish for. The elite have gerrymandered a two-party system, paring down voters' rights with party restrictions, etc. But let's get back to Margaret's question here about the equal time rule. David K. Johnson, you mentioned that earlier. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Back in the 80s, the Democrats were in control of Congress, and they were persuaded to vote for this thing, and it is just beyond reason why they did so. I haven't explored it in depth. There was clearly campaign money and lobbying involved, and lobbying is a constitutional right. The problem is that only those who are donors really get to exercise that right. But there's actually a decent Wikipedia page about this issue, so Margaret might want to look at it.
The other aspect there I would bring up, I did a book in 1988 called "On Bended Knee: The Press and the Reagan Presidency," and it talked about some of these issues. And while it's true that the Democrats did vote for the lifting of that fairness rule, that was part of a larger push by Ronald Reagan and his administration to essentially free broadcasting, both radio and television, from any public obligations, and to allow corporations to own much more.
And these are public stations. These are public airwaves.
Exactly.
Keep in mind, these are public airwaves. And my criticisms here, by the way, I'm the only journalist in America who caused a broadcaster to be forced off the air for news manipulations and blackouts. It's a chain of six TV and radio stations. And if that happened today, the very same things this guy did to misinform people and blackout people he didn't like, he wouldn't be forced off the air. I mean, this is a real serious problem that we need to fix.
And I can't help but mention here to all of you who are listening, this is why your public radio station is important here at KALW, our colleagues at KQED, and all across the nation. These airways by which you are hearing my voice now belong to you, the public. They belong to all of us. And the only way that you're going to be able to continue to enjoy these kinds of conversations that we're having today is to support your local public radio station, KALW. And we have about a couple minutes left here only. I want to ask one quick question of both of you, and you've both kind of said that Trump bats away these questions. And yet last night, there was Megyn Kelly of Fox News, and she, for the first time since August, where she questioned Trump, she really did go after him about the Trump University and so forth. So there's an example. She's working for a right-wing network, and yet she has been and continues to be quite tough about Trump. What can the rest of the press learn from Megyn Kelly, each of you quickly in 30 seconds?
I'll do it very quickly. She asked really good questions, and the reason is that Roger Ailes has decided that they need to take on Trump because it's not good for business.
John Nichols?
I think Megyn Kelly asked some very good questions, but I think she did a lousy job last night. And I think the rest of the moderators did a lousy job last night. They got so into the minutia of Donald Trump's business life, which I think is important, and David well illustrates why we should talk about it. But then they asked some what they, I think, treated as throwaway questions on the Flint water crisis and on the economic crisis in Detroit. They allowed these candidates to literally mouth, you know, age-old, awful, empty talking points, and they never followed up. I thought last night's debate was an especially lousy, poorly done debate, and it was Trump-obsessed and policy-empty.
That's John Nichols, my colleague at The Nation magazine. He's the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and he also contributes at The Progressive and In These Times and Capital Times. And his latest book, co-authored with Robert McChesney, is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Also joining us today has been David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, columnist for USA Today, one of the experts on Donald Trump. His latest book is Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And I'm Mark Hertzgar. This has been KALW's Your Call Media Roundtable on Friday. And on Monday, we'll have a conversation with the filmmakers of Painted Nails. The documentary examines how toxic chemicals used in nail salons affect the lives of their workers. Then on Tuesday, we'll revisit our conversation with the journalist Yon Grillo about his new book, Gangster Warlords: Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. In 2014, U.S. authorities detained more than 60,000 unaccompanied children coming into this country. What does that mean for politics here and in the Caribbean? That's Tuesday, Your Call, with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.